Welcome to the latest episode of the Minorities in Publishing podcast. For new and returning listeners, you may know you can find the podcast on minoritiesinpublishing.tumblr.com or on Twitter at minoritiesinpub. And this is really exciting. I know I say that every episode, but this is super exciting because we have returning guest Jason Reynolds, who you may remember from the Brooke Stevenson dedication episode, and Brendan Kiley, co-authors of All American Boys, recent New York Times bestseller for both. And Jason just won the Kirkus Prize last night and is up bright and shiny to talk to us. So I really thank you, Jason, for being up.
It's all good. I appreciate it.
So Jason's on Skype and Brendan's right next to me, so you may notice the audio variation in that sense. But I just wanted to preface that because we're not all in the same room, but some of us are. So welcome, you two. How are you feeling?
Jason, how are you feeling, man?
Good. Everything is good. I'm just, you know, a little tired. I'm emotionally drained, but I'm, you know, I live in a state of perpetual gratitude. Mm-hmm. I feel really fortunate and really, really lucky that that people care about anything that I've written or that we've written, Brendan, and I'm kind of floating. It's a strange, surreal experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love seeing that photo of you and Ashley Bryan hugging each other, man. That's a special moment.
Oh, man, it was amazing. It was amazing. How you feeling, Brendan? Like, what's going on? How you feeling?
Man, I'm feeling good. I'm feeling excited to get back on the road with you, dude. I can't wait to be on election day together.
Yes.
trying to stay sane. I'm glad to be with you, man. It's going to be crazy.
What's funny is that, and I think I talked to you a bit about it, Brendan, is that All American Boys has been out for over a year.
Yeah.
And the paperback came out recently. And that kind of was the parallel of when y'all's hit the New York Times bestseller list. But I believe you hit the bestseller list for hardcover, not paperback. Was that right?
Yeah, yeah. And actually, the paperback technically is not out. Those paperback editions are special editions for Scholastic and for the One Maryland, One Book. But the technical Simon & Schuster edition of paperback hasn't even come out yet. Mm. So the book did hit the list for hardcover, which was amazing.
Yeah.
But as I've mentioned online, and Jason and I have talked about this too, but I mean, hats off to and huge thanks to all the educators who have been backing this book since, you know, its publication. Mm-hmm. I really feel like the only reason why this book really made it into a sort of larger sphere is because educators have been backing it and have been talking about why they want to get it in the hands of kids. Mm-hmm. And I think their support has just been tremendous.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. I think when we really think about who the warriors are, you know, we have to sort of shout out the librarians and the educators, and people like yourself as well, you know, speaking about you, Jen, and all of the people who sort of have helped to galvanize people around this book. It's not an easy book. It's not an easy subject. Mm-hmm. Many people are terrified of it. We've had our fair share of experience with that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But for the people who have been fighting for it to be in the hands of young people, we just are forever in debt, you know, and we're grateful for your work. Not your work for us, but your work for the community at large.
Absolutely.
Well, what do y'all think about it being, quote unquote, a hot topic, too? Because even when we look at finalists, that National Book Award finalist, that includes you, Jason, for A Ghost, and John Lewis, if you've read March, you see that this is not a recent thing. Like, police brutality is not a recent thing. Brutality on citizens is not a recent thing for blacks and for allies. Mm. So when do you hear that? Do you hear people say, oh, it's such a potent topic right now, or this is so, you know, there's so much potential for this right now? You know, you hear it kind of bookended by right now. How do y'all feel about that when you talk about this book?
Oh, Brendan, let her have it. Tell me what you think.
Well, you gotta throw in here too, man.
I can quote it for you if you want. Here's what Brendan says all the time, and when we give our talk, he always says, "Look, this is how," he always starts with "look," right? He says, "Look, at some point," he says, "at some point, we are going to have to reckon with the fact that there has been not just recent, this isn't a recent thing, but there's been over 400 years of brutality against the bodies of people of color in this country. He says it every time. Every single talk we give, we make it very clear that this is an issue. This is a through line of our country. This is as American, if not more American, than baseball and apple pie. You know, we just let them know. But it's funny, right? It's funny when you hear it, it's like, oh my God, there's this new thing happening. It's called police brutality. It's like, yeah. Unless you grew up in all the neighborhoods that people of color have grown up in, and you realize that police brutality has been as normal as the ice cream truck.
Yeah. and so that bookend of right now feels like that is a phrase that people who have lived in comfort and ease and peace and privilege, saying, I'm made to be more aware of this because I can't escape the news feeds, you know, every day. So this is so that their right now is maybe a right now for their own consciousness, a right now for a sort of national conversation that should always be a national conversation. It's just that it's become something else, something that you hear people referencing all the time on MSNBC or on CNN or on Fox News, and that's not a right now. It's a right now for them. So what I find fascinating about the sort of what I think about in terms of your question is when Jason and I have been traveling around the country and speaking with over 30,000 students in various communities all around the country, it's fascinating to see how, for some kids, that they're, this isn't like a, oh, I'm being made aware of this for the first time. This is a, wow, finally people are talking about a story that feels like so relevant, it's my neighborhood. I'm saddened by that it feels like it's taken this long for some people to say, finally, here's a story that I can relate to. And Jason, you talk about that all the time with, you know, some of the reasoning and the motivation behind what you're trying to write and publish.
For sure. For sure. I think invisibility, you know, I think my whole career is going to be fighting against invisibility, pushing back against invisibility, whether it be in police brutality or in the everyday normal lives of black and brown kids in America who are hyper visible and invisible at the same time.
So if you two don't mind talking about it, it's okay if you don't, I can edit it out. But there have been places that have been averse to y'all coming and speaking about this. And you did say that it's the educators primarily, I'm sure librarians and other entities as well have been really bumping up this book as well, necessarily. But there do seem to be places that are not hype about this conversation. And do you think it's been mainly the school environments that have been averse to it, or it's really those have been the most welcoming and that maybe just your random indie bookstore is not feeling like, yeah, we want to have that, those two guys who wrote that police brutality book here, because that's a downer.
Right.
But at least with the school environment, you kind of have it involved in this, curated into a larger discussion of what students can actively do. Because I've seen the pictures, I've seen what students have actually brought to the table in terms of how they want to celebrate this book as well.
Right. I mean, I feel like, so just two things I think that are okay to share, because I think we've also talked about it pretty publicly in other places as well. Is, so at the very beginning of our tour last year, one of the places that had trouble, they invited us to speak, but they had trouble, they didn't want us to speak about All American Boys, was in the municipality of St. Anne's, which is right next to Ferguson in Missouri. And the reasoning behind it was, look, you're here, but we're nervous because there are too many people in the community who whose family members are police officers. And so the idea behind their asking us not to talk about the book was to protect the families of police officers, to not feel like they are under threat. Mm-hmm. That kind of protection goes directly to the heart of what we were just talking about before, that this is a sort of making the world safe and comfortable and peaceful for the people who have, in effect, been perpetuating violence against bodies of color for 400 plus years. So to perpetuate that kind of protection of privilege is perpetuating violence, in my book. I don't think that the administrators are consciously thinking that way, mm-hmm. but their actions result in that effect. Mm-hmm. And that's a real shame, especially because as we witnessed while we were there, talking about literacy and talking about, you know, why we want to get folks to, young folks to read, the first or second question from the students was, hey, how come you guys aren't talking about your book, All American Boys? We want to hear about that. And the fact that kids want to hear about it, the kids know about it, the kids are living in a community where everyone needs to discuss it, uh-huh. it means it's a real disservice to ever take this book out of the hands of kids or to block any conversation about the book from happening in the community. Mm-hmm. In my book. I don't know. What do you think, Jason?
No, I feel the same way. I mean, to get at your question, it's been... librarians in schools have been great. Administration in schools are where the problems lie, right? Mm-hmm. Because the administration is where the heat's going to come if this all goes bust. Mm-hmm. And so they're the ones who are like super squeamish and nervous and eggshelling the issue. But the librarians are the rebels of the schools who are like, no, you know, librarians in America, as we all know, are anti-censorship for the most part. A large body of them are anti-censorship, and they're pushing all the things that they think are necessary, even if it's against the administration. And so at St. Anne's, for instance, the librarian had already prepped the kids about All American Boys.
Right, right.
It was the principal who had pushed back and was like, I don't know if this is a good idea. There was a school out in, where were we? In Boonesboro, I think, and the sheriff called the librarian the morning before we got there and told them that he was disappointed in the fact that they were allowing us to come to the school. But the librarian was like, well, it's happening anyway. And so I think that it's in school specifically, it's the librarians who are fighting the good fight, but the higher-ups are making it mm-hmm. difficult sometimes because they're trying to cover their own butts, right? And I understand that as well. But who always, unwaveringly, shows up for the discussion are the kids.
Yep.
No matter what demographic, no matter where we are, no matter what the population, no matter what the race, the kids always show up for the discussion, and they're ready to talk about it. They're ready to talk about it every single time.
Just as a counterpoint to the narrative of people who want to shut things down, administrations who want to shut things down, or sheriff's offices, or school community boards in one community in Texas, for example. The counterpoint to that is, so that I think a lot of that comes from this fear that if we come in and we talk about it, there will be anti-police sentiment, or there will be more reason for there to be fire and discord in the community. The problem with that philosophy is that the opposite is true in so many communities. One great example is in Waltham, Massachusetts, where All American Boys was the all-summer read for their high school. Mm-hmm. They invited us to come speak at the beginning of the year. We did a presentation for the whole high school. The next week, they had one day off from school, but everybody had to go to the school and do individual workshops mm-hmm. based on issues and ideas and concepts that come out of the novel. Mm-hmm. And they had group conversations with local police officers. Police officers were in the workshops with the students, working together in communication mm-hmm. in a way that was like fostering actual dialogue. A safe environment, a place where kids and police officers could get to know each other mm-hmm. and talk about, this is why we feel this way, this is why we feel this way. That's productive. I mean, there's no way to get mm-hmm. beyond... It's like the Dr. Seuss bread and butter war. If we just stay on either side of the wall and we scream, mm-hmm. butter on the top, butter on the bottom, butter on the top, butter on the bottom, we're never going to get to a point where we can actually, mm-hmm. you know, make things work, I hope, for the better.
Yeah, yeah. Because it seems like we're in this kind of perpetual state of hurt feelings. And I hear this all the time, especially on Facebook. It's just like, but I'm not this, as if by... speaking out on an issue that affects a specific demographic, you're automatically negating any sympathy for the other side.
Yeah. And more to the point, me, white person, my like my comfort and my need for people to you know, take care of me and sympathize with my like, oh, it's not me, is harmful if I'm sucking up that energy mm-hmm. away from a conversation of voices from communities of color saying, you know, we've had enough. This mm-hmm. is perpetual violence against mm-hmm. our bodies, against our families, against our history, our legacy, our culture, like all of this. Mm-hmm. If I'm just asking for someone to take care of my feelings in the moment, mm-hmm. that's, mm-hmm. You know, perpetuating the injustice, I think. So yeah. That's, yeah.
I hold everyone to the Brendan standard.
it's a tough standard. I think about this all the time. I'm like, man, I tell kids all the time with Brendan next to me, I say, you know, the reason that I'm able to maintain some sense of peace, I think that the reason that I can look at the world and still see a glimmer of hope is because I can look at Brendan and say, all right, there's a person out here who is actively trying mm-hmm. not just to talk the talk, mm-hmm. But trying to actually live the example, right? And be this way. And he understands, I tell him all the time, you don't get no cookie for being human.
Exactly.
Right? Mm-hmm. I'm not going to pat you on the back for you being a whole human being, right?
Exactly.
But I think it is, it's a powerful thing to witness a white person using the privilege for the betterment of the community, right? That's because mm-hmm. you can't shake the privilege off.
Yeah.
So you might as well learn how to use it to create more safety for mm-hmm. the community at large.
Exactly.
Also, as a white person, it's a gift to be, I think, invited into many of these conversations that have been happening for years and years and years mm-hmm. and years and years. And so I never take that invitation lightly. mm-hmm. So
I have a lot of people you can talk to, Brendan.
Well, actually, I have to say, I'm nervous because next week, Jason and I are speaking in Rochester, New York, and I know I'll be speaking in front of a whole heck of a lot of family, extended family, so, woo! It's going to be fun.
You gotta nut up.
Oh, yeah, man. Bringing the same game I always do. I'll just have to deal with the drinks dates afterwards on my own. I won't drag you into that.
listen, man. You taking care of me on the road. I'll take good care of you. Don't you worry. It's all good.
Oh man, it's awesome. It's a mutual thing. Hey, actually, speaking of which, Jason took care of me when we were leaving Baton Rouge. I'll tell you what. Man, I was surprised I got up. I appreciate that.
Man.
The dynamic duo.
Well, it's a ride. It's a ride. It's awesome.
A year plus long one, though. I don't know anyone who's toured this much for anything, unless they're a band. But you still touring for that album?
I think that's been the most amazing thing, though, is that we've gotten to see. Here's the sweet thing: we've got at the beginning of our tour, which was last year, we got to sort of take the temperature of young America, right? And we were talking mm-hmm. to them about these things and asking questions, and we got to see that there were so many of them who knew about police brutality but weren't talking about it. Now the book's been out for a year, we asked those same questions, and there are far more young people who are like, oh yeah, we're talking about it, mm-hmm. right? Which is amazing mm-hmm. to think about over the course of a year. Not that it's all American boys, but to think about the fact that perhaps the book is doing its job, which is what all writers, at least what I speak for myself, which is what I would want mm-hmm, for the book mm-hmm. to be used as a tool,
yeah,
and for the book to actually be functional and doing an actual thing, right? There, mm-hmm. there used to be this poem long time. I can't remember. I think it was Nikki Giovanni or somebody who said, you know, a poem, poetry alone doesn't save a life, mm-hmm, right? But mm-hmm. to think about like that this book could somehow grow legs of its own and serve as a safe space for these conversations. Every single time we do this, a white kid walks up to Brendan and says, I am Quint. I want to talk about it, but I am so afraid. And this book has helped me understand my role, understand mm-hmm. what it is that I can do and who I am and what that means in a larger conversation. That is a powerful, powerful thing for a 14 or 15 year old to experience, because that 14 year old, God willing, will one day be 40 mm-hmm. and will look at the world differently.
And will either be a police officer, a lawyer, you know, somebody working in a hospital, somebody who's working in housing, somebody, you know, mm-hmm. all of these institutions that perpetuate racism and systemic racism and institutional racism, perpetuated because of people not, white people in particular, not reflecting on these positions of power. And so for young folks to have avenues to begin to be more race conscious, as opposed to aspiring to that awful idea of colorblindness, I think is one thing I can say I look towards, hopefully. And I always use that word hope with a lot of reticence, because especially for a white person to talk about hope when it's with regards to racism is you know, I tread that line very, very, very carefully.
You got someone in the back just shaking their head.
Exactly.
I hope don't pay rent.
Exactly.
What are you talking about?
Exactly.
Well, speaking of colorblindness, so I feel this is a question for both of you, but I think Jason might be able to speak to it a little bit more, is that this idea of you become pigeonholed, right? You write something, it takes off, and then you become that author, right? So with All American Boys, do you both feel like you're going to be pigeonholed as the guys who wrote that police brutality novel? But also, Jason, being a person of color, you know, I feel like in a way you're seen as the black author. You know what I mean? Like, identifiably black, very open, unapologetically black. But I also feel like some people just look at, well, dang, we need some representation. Jason's black. You know, and it becomes like that. It's not just Jason's a good artist, Jason does, you know, Jason's been well received, it's he fits to, you know, make this a little bit more quote unquote colorful. So do you both feel like you're being pigeonholed with the success of this book, as well as the content that you're writing about, but also who you are? Because Brendan, your current book is very different from All American Boys and your debut.
I'll just say this, and then I want to pass the mic to Jason. I don't know any other writer that's Jason's age and who has been in the business as long, who has published consistently as much spectacular work, and whose career is lauded with so many recognitions of talent and craft. Every conference for the next 3 years should have a masterclass session offered by Jason Reynolds. Because that is, no, for real. I mean, that's a conversation I wish we could perpetuate more. Mm-hmm. That look at the work that's being produced. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I just have to, you know, tip my hat there, my friend.
I appreciate it, man. I think, you know, I, to be honest with you, Jen, I think I struggle with this, right? I come from the tradition that many of us come from, which is that which says that there's no such thing as art for art's sake when you are a person of color in America. Mm-hmm. That everything you said, that we don't have the privilege of ambiguity, right? And everything you says needs to be intentional. Everything you write needs to be intentional. I come from that school of thought, right? And so do I think about the pigeonhole? I don't necessarily think about the pigeonhole, because I think that the pigeonhole people are trying to put me in, to me, is just me doing my work. Regardless, right? Like I know what it is that I'm trying to do, and I know what it is that I'm trying to say. And so, the pigeonhole that they think they're putting me in is a house I built for myself, right? It's a house that I built for myself to reside in, and I'm totally okay with that. I also think, though, my work ethic, the reason that I've worked so hard, and the reason that I know for a fact that, and I've said this to my editor, and she knows this. The reason that I work so hard is because when we talk about privilege, we talk about it as if it's a hammer slamming down on us, when in reality is oftentimes it's a lot more implicit. There's passive privilege. And what passive privilege looks like is me having to write 12, 13, 14 books to force a door open that I'm scared is going to be closed on me. Right? That has nothing to do with me and everything to do with the industry and how it's set up and how afraid and the insecurity that exists when you are a writer of color in this game, right? And you and your team and all these other people are pushing against that to open that up for me and us and everybody coming after us, and to honor those who came before us. And that's an amazing thing. But But that's sort of what it's had to be for me. I've had to work really hard to knock the doors off the jams to make sure that they can't ignore me. And since they can't ignore me, at this point, I have a little more leverage to do what I want, right? Mm-hmm. But I had to sort of do three times the work as my colleague sometimes to get, me and Brendan always talk about how, like, yeah, you get all these literary awards, but I'm always asked to be on a diversity panel, not on a craft panel.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, and that's frustrating. But I also know that at this point, I'm trying to figure out how to leverage some of the awards and some of the sort of notoriety so that I can turn that corner and help us turn that corner as a whole. I look at Nicola Yoon and what she's been able to do. You know, I look at DJ Older and how he's been able to normalize sort of magical realism in the contemporary sense for young people, which is a huge deal, because 3 years ago, to imagine black people and magic in the contemporary time would have seemed a lot stranger than it does now. Mm-hmm. But because of him, so I think we're working. And as long as we're all working, we can fight against the pigeonholes. As long as you keep doing your job and WNDB keeps doing their jobs and all these librarians who really know what time it is keep doing their jobs, then we're all good. We're all good, and our children will be better off for it as well.
The question about pigeonholing for me is just a different one, and it's tricky for me because I have a lot of pressure from all sides in the industry to write something different, to not be an issue-oriented writer, to strive to find a way to create a broader market, because honestly, my books on my own do not sell on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and those channels. They just don't sell commercially. Mm-hmm. So the pressure is, how do you change your career, Brendan, to become somebody that is still worth publishing in their eyes? Mm-hmm. Which is frustrating to me, because the stuff that I care about most are tied to the passions that are most important to me. So I necessarily want to talk about All American Boys or In the Gospel of Winter, it was a story about abuse of power, basically. Mm-hmm. And the courage of those folks who really take a stand against it. Mm-hmm. That's just, on some level, it seems to me that's the same central theme of the freaking Hunger Games, but that is somehow more appealing than to talk about how actually these stories exist in our everyday real lives. Mm-hmm. And there are young folks and older folks too who want to see themselves or their own stories realized in realistic fiction. Mm-hmm. And it's a shame. It's a shame to get a lot of pressure to try to write other mm-hmm. kinds of work. Mm-hmm. Truthfully, I wrote The Last True Love Story before All American Boys, because there was already that pressure, because The Gospel of Winter just didn't do well commercially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was interesting. I was on a craft panel with Zoraida Cordova, Heidi Heilig, and Tracy Batiste. And it was a craft panel. Like, I very much enforced that, but it was diversity, and that was the title. It was called Diversity in Sci-Fi and Fantasy. I was like, yeah, all right, pitch it how you want. But when we talked about it, I mentioned, so y'all have colonialism here, and people were like, what? And I said, yeah, did you not notice that, even though, Tracy's book talks about slavery, it's a middle grade, and then other, Heidi's book brought up slavery. Like, everyone's book had colonialism in it, but they were fantastical. So it's interesting you bring up the Hunger Games, because colonialism, mm-hmm. so many books are about colonialism, but I feel like in what you're saying is that people feel comfortable when that colonialism, it seems, quote unquote, imagined, rather than being in contemporary, because then they don't have to face the reality.
Yeah. Right, right.
That's what I think. And it makes me really sad that would be an expectation in the world of for writing for young people, because, mm-hmm. I feel like young people, we don't give them enough credit for being able to really grapple with the reality. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, that said, I also wonder who grabs the books off the shelf and in the bookstores, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. If they're looking for fantasy and sci-fi more often. And now maybe it's a good thing. I mm-hmm. just to sort of turn the table back on ourselves here. So yes, I write realistic fiction, but I love that kind of work that people are doing in sci-fi and fantasy mm-hmm. and all kinds of genre fiction to sort of subvert, you know, or to add layers of meaning to an adventure story mm-hmm. that's also a discussion about colonialism. I mean,
yeah.
that's awesome.
Yeah.
And people have been doing that kind of work for years and years and years and years and years
mm-hmm.
and maybe not have had not been given enough credit or been given enough shine by the critics mm-hmm. because they're quote-unquote genre, and they really are doing tremendously intellectual and engaging
yeah.
work. So they deserve a lot of credit.
But it's also because when going to the bookstores, right, there's but so much shelf space.
Mm.
So how do you earn, quote-unquote, I use air quotes a lot, sorry. how do you earn that shelf space? Because I remember I was talking to Brendan when his new book came out,
mm-hmm.
right after it came out, and American Boys was there. You could find American Boys. I could not find Gospel of Winter. And I found the new book because it was new.
Yeah.
But there was this huge display of bestsellers. And this was right before All American Boys became in that league as well, monetarily, as you say.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I found Nicola. I found a Divergent series. I found things that were 2 to 3 years old.
Yeah.
You know, Salman Chainani's first books and all that stuff, Saba Tahir's. They had a huge, huge display for their stuff. And then when I went for the more contemporary stuff, John Green was also in the, had a huge thing.
Right.
So it was so much, so few shelf space, so that if your book had not just come out.
Yeah.
Or had not been seemingly doing well, you didn't get that shelf space at Barnes & Noble. And that particular one did not have a big young writers category. I mean, for picture books, it was ridiculous. But for YA and MG, it was not. So it's kind of like you're constantly fighting for this shelf space. And what does that kind of do with this constant level of touring and discussing the issues and for people being able to find those books? So if they love American All American Boys, oh, I can't find, you know.
Right.
When I Was the Greatest, I can't find Gospel of Winter.
Yeah.
So.
I mean, that's sort of a catch, though. That's sort of the catch, though, right? And I think that Brendan and I always have a discussion about, you know, there are so many different ways and different tracks that people take, right? So, like, you have, you know, Subba and Nicola Yoon and all of our contemporaries and our colleagues who, for one reason or another, had the ability to sell out of the bookstores, right?
Mm-hmm.
I hate that people call them commercial writers because a lot of them, most of them are actually really brilliant. Commercials seem so condescending to me.
Yeah.
But they're selling commercially, right? And
mm-hmm.
what has to happen for people like myself, people like Brendan, is we've had to pound the pavement.
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay too, right? But it's just a different route we've had to take. We may not get the marketing dollars for our particular books, for whatever reason, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we have to do 50, 60, 70 school visits a year. And so it may take a little longer, but we'll get there, right? It'll happen. It just takes a little longer. We have to sort of go and hand sell every single one of these books to groups of young people and then hope that they tell their friends, and hope that their teachers tell their fellow teachers, and that those teachers will tell their friends. And that's sort of how it's had to be for us, you know?
Mm-hmm.
All American Boys has moved thousands and thousands and thousands of units, but it's moved those units through the educational channel. So they're not clicked the same. They're not counted the same. That's sort of how people are like, I can't believe it took you guys a year to hit the list. And it's like, well, there's a lot of politics involved in how All American Boys and all of our books sort of move and matriculate through the commerce system that's
mm-hmm.
different. It's not like buying it out of Barnes & Noble. It's like buying it in bulk from the company, from the publishing company, and distributing them around the country. So thousands of kids had, right, 150,000 kids have All American Boys, right, which is a whole lot of people, but we just hit the list because the book scan works a little differently when you're selling through the educational channel.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
So that seems like it's like do royalties, you know what I mean? Like, oh, okay, so they're going to be on the list for the next 6 months because we totally forgot to count.
They're sold at a different price. It's all different.
Discounted price, yeah.
And it's such a different thing. I mean, I think that's why there's so much marketing dollars put into the books that have an opportunity to debut on the list, because if you debut on the list, like, you know, Subba or somebody when their book comes out, mm-hmm. Leigh Bardugo, once you're on the list from the beginning week of publication, the likelihood of staying on the list, mm-hmm. You know, it's exponential growth.
Yeah.
I mean, it makes sense. Why wouldn't anybody want to make more money? But, you know, just on a flip note too, I remember talking with our publicist because I was like surprised that she was able to get back to me on email so quickly because mm-hmm. I said, I know you work on a lot of books. Like, mm-hmm. I'm always so grateful that you even respond to my email.
Yeah, she's very quick.
She's awesome.
Props to Beth. She's very quick.
Beth and Katie too. And mm-hmm. Katie is, and actually I was talking to Katie about this. I said, how many books do you work on a year? And she said, over 100.
Yeah, that includes backlist.
Well, yeah, and it's, I mean, that makes, when your question about shelf space, I mean, there's just no time for a book, and the bookstore doesn't have the, you know, has to pay rent, so they can't, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. they can't keep stuff around, and it's tough.
It's tough. But it's all good.
It is.
You know what I'm saying? Like, at the end of the day, for all my homies who are killing it out of the store, I got mad love and respect for what they do, and I'm happy. I couldn't be happier. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Oh,
it's
yeah.
just that in order for Brendan and I to make that same headway, we've got to take a different route. That's all. And we have to be willing to take that route. That's all.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And when I say it's tough, I mean for the bookstores. Like, I feel like in many ways, I want the bookstores to exist much more than I want me to exist. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Because I want bookstores to be there for everybody. So.
Sure.
So I'd like to talk about the collaborative process between you two, because you knew each other beforehand. Yes, this wasn't random.
Yeah. This wasn't random. It was like we just met, you know, they put us together.
Yeah.
Star-crossed writers.
You're a literal spin the bottle of like, this works. Make it happen.
No, we met on tour. The publishing company put us on tour with Corey Whaley and Chris Lynch, and it was cool. And so we all met at that point. And Brendan and I, you got to remember, right? This is just after the Trayvon Martin case.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so this tour is beginning just after George Zimmerman is found not guilty. Mm-hmm. And here we are on tour, and of course I'm all kinds of in my feels about everything. I'm frustrated, I'm angry, I'm confused, I'm mad, I'm sad, I'm all, you know, all the things. And above all, I'm an adult, which means I have to be a responsible adult in a space full of strangers and not talk about politics and religion and make this a very long tour, right? And so what ends up happening is Brendan and I, the conversation sort of comes up organically, and Brendan and I start to actually have this discussion around Trayvon Martin and around how I felt. And I like to be very clear about this moment, because it's important to note that what Brendan did in that moment is he created a safe space for me to be all the way human, right? He ain't trying to fix it. He ain't trying to defend nothing. He didn't try to explain it away, right? He let me be upset. He let me be a human being. He let me cry and bang on the table and curse and do all the things that I needed to do to express how I felt. And not just how I felt on that day, but how I've been feeling for my life, right? And my mom's life and my siblings' lives and my friends' lives. And after that conversation, we sort of just went down the rabbit hole. And we would have those really uncomfortable talks every day. And we'd have it out. And there were the talks that I'm always going to value these moments, because they were probably the most honest conversations that I had had outside of my own culture ever. You know, like really intense, uncomfortable, healthy discussions. And we did that every day for months and months and months and months and months until Mike Brown was killed in Ferguson, and that is sort of what ended up sparking what would become All American Boys. Mm.
I really appreciate those moments as well, because as I was saying before, you know, I never take lightly entering into any real honest conversation about race, because essentially we were talking about, you know, how our lives are affected by this, right? And I never take that lightly. So it's as I mentioned in another interview recently, it's kind of like a magical moment where you recognize that you've been asked to be somebody. You got to show up, and I think that it's, you know, I'm forever grateful that that we spent all this time together building this friendship. And as I say, when we're in front of the kids, you know, of course, as a white person in a conversation about race in America, I got to listen three times as much as I talk, if not more, right? Mm-hmm. My first job is to listen and listen and listen. Mm-hmm. And if we can encourage that kind of shift in the dialogue about race in America so that white culture chooses to listen first as opposed to dictate or create excuses or say but or this is just an isolated case or this is just nice, instead of already forming a counter rebuttal, mm-hmm, 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 to just sit and listen, mm-hmm, I think that would go a long way in a macro cultural experience. And so when we were going to work on All American Boys together, the reason why we were, I think, really able to do this book and do it so quickly was that we had formed a real basis of trust. Mm-hmm. And that trust is, the book emerges from this space of trust. Mm-hmm. And that's the most important thing of all. And as we said from the very beginning, our rule number one was, look, if the friendship goes bust for any reason in the process of working on this book, then the whole project is a bust. Like, what's the point of the book or the project or anything that we're talking about if something happens to the friendship? So it's that kind of commitment that I will forever be grateful for, because it's like, yes, yes, the friendship has to be first.
and we check in with each other, right? We hold each other accountable, right?
Absolutely.
If either of us are misstepping or if either of us seem to be losing focus, we talk, we check in. Right? Yeah. Are we still in it for the right reasons? Are we still working and doing the thing that we set out to do? Has this become about notoriety? Have we are we losing it? Are we losing ourselves in the midst of all the noise? And we check in regularly to make sure that he and I, that our friendship is solid, and that our intentions behind All American Boys remain solid. This wasn't no get rich quick scheme, right? Yeah, we even talked about how if we ever made money from it, we donate portions of that money to organizations who are doing this work.
Exactly.
Don't anybody trying to get rich on blood money?
Exactly.
Right? These are discussions that we had from the beginning, before we even put one word on the page, so that we knew for a fact that no matter what, whether they published it or not, whether it flopped or it succeeded, that we were going to be solid as humans and as friends, and stand on what we say we believe in.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And have Hank been... Because I've had the opportunity to be around you both in the same room together, there's that organic friendship that everyone notices so immediately. And I'm sure that when you go on tour, people notice it as well. So, you know, this doesn't come off as gimmicky. Like, like you're saying, Jason, the get rich quick scheme. Because I didn't think that, but, you know, you hear about two people and you're like, oh, no. Oh, no. This is very sensitive.
Yeah.
But then seeing how genuine everyone is about the process and the topic, I really feel like when people see you and hear you both together or even separately, but especially together, it really helps to bring forth the importance of the conversation, mm-hmm, the realism that these friendships exist, mm-hmm, and that they're built. And that, I think, is catered to the book's success, if not just the content and the writing, your relationship as people.
For sure. I think it's been helpful. I mean, we've been in some really precarious situations, and what oftentimes buffers some of the situations is people's observation of the two of us. Mm-hmm. So you can feel however you want to feel about race, you can feel however you want to feel about politics, but there's no way that you're going to be able to deny what love looks like from two people who are very different, from different backgrounds, different ideas. You won't be able to escape a palpable love that like you, and so you're gonna have to deal with that, right? And it's harder for you to be mad or disgruntled or defensive when two people who clearly are down for each other are standing in front of you telling you that we all have work to do. It makes it really hard for all the haters out there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The haters gonna hate though. Hashtag haters gonna hate. Jason's like, we're going out for dinner right now. Whatever. You be in your feelings.
And like Jim, we in Baton Rouge. We on a radio show in Baton Rouge.
Oh.
And talking about all kinds of stuff. And you know what happened? The guy says, all right, we're gonna take some callers. The phone lines light up, right? Caller number one, you're on, right? And they just light into us. I mean, they just start, I mean, they are crushing us, right? And at the end of it, I walk out and I'm like, for me, like you say, haters gonna hate. I ain't worried about these people, right? And but it's so cool because Brendan was Brendan took it a little differently
than
me.
Yep.
But I gotta be honest with you, it is normal for me to be like, and you for that matter, to be like, haters gonna hate. Right. Mm-hmm. For Brendan, he took it a little more personally, and in that moment, we had a discussion about it. But it also is really good for me to know that there are people who still feel something. Mm-hmm. That there are people who still are bothered and are not jaded and callous. I don't have a choice but to be callous by and to be protective of bigotry. Right? I shake it off because I don't have no choice. There ain't nothing. Right? Mm-hmm. Whereas he can feel it in a different way because it's outside of his wheelhouse when it comes to a personal sort of touch with it. Mm-hmm. And that was a fascinating experience for the two of us. They let us have it.
they did let us have it. And I was physically uncomfortable. I was like, this is disgusting. God, it's just, I could just hear the echoes of my own ignorance bubbling around me right there. But And the flip side, the other thing about a moment in Baton Rouge, to your point about the two of us on stage together, I was so heartened by one of the schools we went to in particular that it felt to me like here are some students who, to my mind, look like they have real relationships with each other across racial lines in ways that I, even as a teacher at a school in New York, for many years, didn't see quite so easily all the time. Mm-hmm. And I really appreciated that. It looked, and you know, this is an outsider's perspective and I have no idea, but on the flip side of all that hate that we were catching on the radio at a distance, when we were in the school with some young people, there was something really powerful about some of the relationships that I felt like I was witnessing there, because we spent a lot of time with some of the kids, and that was great. And likewise, another moment at that same school in Waltham, Massachusetts, you know, people always ask us about, next projects and are we going to work on something together again? And we often like to try to encourage the young folks that maybe they're the ones who can write the sequel. Maybe they're the ones who can continue to have this conversation, but with each other and co-write some other kind of book or something. And there were these two girls, and I'll never forget it because it was genuine surprise that struck both of them at the same time. When we were sort of leaning down over the stage and telling them this, and one girl was white and one girl was black, and they looked at each other with this moment of genuine, like, it's us! And they, like, hugged each other. This amazing moment. And so for me, like, yeah, I hear those haters on the radio, and I think to myself, yeah, this is so physically disturbing, but I also want to hold dear those moments where I'm seeing, you know, young folks literally holding themselves in such joy that they can work together. I mean, that's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So how do you feel when you're having these conversations? I mean, you're, like we said, you've been on tour for this book for over a year. You're doing more touring next week, presumably more touring after that. I mean, what kind of physical and emotional toll does it take to talk to young people, and not just young people, older people, about an issue that isn't going away, that's never gone away?
Yeah.
I mean, how do you decompress after that too, you know?
Oh, we drink.
Yeah. it's not a healthy way of decompressing.
I mean, that's good. We are all the way grown, and that is not a joke. We go and have a couple drinks. That's what happened.
Yeah.
And we also, this is the upside about having a friend, right? Because we also talk about it all the time, right? We get to use each other as therapists, and we get to just talk it out and really have intimate moments where we can express the way that we're feeling about certain moments that may have happened throughout the day. Because every day is a new day. Every crowd's a new crowd. Every group of students are new students. And there's always one or two moments that will either fill you with hope or that will crush you for the moment. And we process those things. And the healthiest way that we can, which oftentimes is over a spirit or two, and a decent meal, and it's all good. But I have to tell you, Jim, this tour has been exhausting, but it has been absolutely encouraging too. I mean, for all the people who listen to this podcast, I need them to know that our young people are not lost. Our young people are not by the wayside, like everybody says. They are not disengaged, nor are they disillusioned. They are all right. They're all right, and I know that, and Brendan knows that, because we get to talk to them every day in droves, and we get to touch them and be around them and see the light that they have, you know.
And I feel like we owe it to them to keep going. On some level, I mean, you know, obviously there are many other things that we need to be doing in our lives and our careers, but I feel deeply committed. Like when people say, hey, we really want you to come talk at our school, it's really, really, really hard for me not to just automatically say, of course, of course, of course, like, we'll be there. You know, like, you know, obviously we physically can't do that all the time, but the fact that somebody wants us to come, the fact that there are kids who want to have that experience to talk with us about all of this as well, it feels like, you know, we owe it to them. They're the ones who have the energy to do something more about it, and they're the ones who are kind of open-minded enough to not have as many, as Jason often says, to not have as many scars. And so there's something about that I feel like I want to honor the potential, honor their potential by going and speaking to them. And it's, you know, it's also true that there's it's just a remarkable privilege to be able to see the country and to meet all of these people. I mean, it's just, it's tiring. I've gained some weight. I think I popped a few blood vessels.
Jason's shaking his head. He's like, yes. Facts.
But at the end of the day,
I can't have any more fried calamari. Oh my god. So much calamari.
Yeah. Yeah, we have these other stories too. I mean, there's all this kind of stuff, but there's also all the eating stories and the.
Oh man, funny story.
Every place has French fries for the most part.
Oh yes.
When in doubt, French fries.
They say French fries.
We've eaten them.
Well, thank you both so much for your time, especially in this continuous whirlwind month of touring, and Jason is literally off to the airport. And so thank you for your time, and thank you for All American Boys. And, you know, I just really want to just say how much I appreciate you both, because y'all are just really cool peeps, always been supportive, doing the work out there, just always willing to lend a hand, even when you're super busy. So
well,
you should buy their, they've written other books, people. So let's just remind them that they've written.
You know, I think it's important that we also, you know, we got to give flowers to the people while they still hit the smell of them. And I, you have to also know that you're a huge piece of this puzzle. And we are also grateful, and not just Brendan and I, but the community at large, even the ones that you make mad. We're all very grateful for your voice and for what you have chosen, for the platform in which you have chosen. We appreciate you, Jen. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Absolutely. And it's, you know, you post these moments of gratitude all the time online.
On
and
Facebook. Yeah, on Twitter, yeah. I just yell at people.
But I hope you feel it back, because
it's
a real deal.
So. Oh, safe travels next week. Safe travels today, Jason, next week.
Thank you. I'll see y'all later.
All right, man. See you in 2 days.
Good rest.
Be well, man.
For those who know already, I'm going to remind you that you can find the podcast on Twitter at MinoritiesInPub and Tumblr at minoritiesinpublishing.tumblr.com. And you can find both Brendan and Jason on Twitter and Facebook and all that good stuff. And if you would like to request them to come to your school, you can reach out to their publicist on their respective websites. And it'd be great if you paid them. Just saying. So thanks again for listening in, and talk to y'all soon.